WIOX is supported by the following community underwriters. Pika Moose Restaurant on State Route 28 in Big Indian, with farm-to-table cuisine Thursday through Monday. Indoor dining from 4 to 9 p.m. and outdoor dining on the moonlit deck. Takeout till 10. PikaMoose.com or 845-254-6500. 845-254-6500. Home Goods of Margaretville, corner of Main and Bridge Streets in Margaretville, New York. Now carrying spices, flour, jams, mustards, coffee and tea, organic vegetables and fruits, and local eggs, milk, cheese, and baked goods. And, of course, cooking basics and tools of the trade for everyone at home. Home Goods of Margaretville. Open every day. 845-586-4177 or hgom.net. 1053 Main Street Gallery and Fleischmann's, designed as a space to support a vibrant and active artistic community nestled in the Catskill Mountains. 1053 Main Street Gallery presents Falling Forward, a solo exhibition of paintings by artist Gary Mayer, on view through Sunday, February 13th. Open Friday and Saturday from 11 to 5, Sunday from 12 to 4, and by appointment. Information about the gallery and upcoming exhibitions at 1053maingallery.com. Restless Works, a contemporary architectural interior and graphic design studio specializing in residential, commercial, and hospitality projects. Based in Andes, Restless Works designs new homes, additions and renovations, kitchens, hotels, restaurants, and studio spaces throughout the Catskills, the Hudson Valley, and New York City. More information at 845-676-6190. 845-676-6190 or restlessworks.com.
Hi, this is Carol Seitz, inviting you to take a musical journey with me down the rabbit hole. Alternate Tuesday mornings at 10 right here on WIOX Roxbury. Community radio, live and local in the Catskills at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXradio.org.
All right, you're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM, MTC Cable Channel 20 on the campus of SUNY Delhi at 107.5 FM, and at WIOXradio.org and on your mobile device with any FM radio app. This is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talking about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John's out tonight. We got Zane. Zane, how you doing? Doing all right. Let me turn up your mic so we can hear you. There you go.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you just fine. So what have you been up to?
Well, been on properties with members. We're doing apple tree prunings.
For the Catskill Forest Association?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. we certainly got our snow.
Yeah, snow cometh. And what was it, Tuesday? We're in Columbia County, and it was a high of 6 or 7?
Yeah.
Something like that. It's going to be cold, though, this weekend.
Oh, yeah. A lot of wind came afterward, too.
Yeah.
Made the snow all nice and crusty.
Yeah. Not complaining.
Like crust.
Yeah, you know, my favorite is when it's about 20, 25 degrees, no wind. It's perfect. I love that. It's good working weather. But what else you been up to? Anything else? Anything you seeing out there in the woods? Noteworthy?
Well, speaking of that crust, what I did see is, you know, with all that wind we've got, that's a great surface for seeds to get blown across. And I've seen a lot of seeds of birch, pine seeds, alders, hophorn beam, they all get blown across the surface and maybe to new sites to establish.
Yeah.
But if not, it's a perfect food source for winter animals.
You saw that recently with an ironwood or hophorn beam, right?
I saw hophorn beam. Rabbit tracks all around and what I believe to be maybe coyote tracks as well.
Well, it looks like the maple sugaring season is going to escape January, and we are into February safely for tapping trees. That's not always a given. A lot of times I've tapped in January, but I think we're safely into February, which is approaching normal, right?
Yep.
Right, Gary?
Right, absolutely.
That's Gary Mead. Every third Wednesday we talk to Gary, and usually we talk about a different Catskills tree, but tonight is going to be a continuing of last month's show where you got up to 1984, right?
Land ownership, yep.
In New Kingston, Delaware County.
Yep.
So we're starting 1985, is that what you're saying, Gary?
1985, yep. We've made it from 64 to 84 last. I can bring us up from 85 to present this month's show.
Just to summarize, you grew up in New Kingston on a dairy farm?
On a dairy farm, and we moved down the property in 1964 in the spring. And
you moved from Greene County, right?
We from Westkill. That's Greene County, I believe, yeah. But I was 10 years old when I moved. We moved from a 40-acre farm to a, well, and the deed said 200 acres plus or minus. When we had it surveyed, it was 256 acres. And,
yeah.
You know, my dad, 1985, November 22nd, 85, my dad was forced to sell the cows and the equipment.
What do you mean? Oh, yeah, because of why?
Debt. That got him. And, you know, he had all these mortgages, and he just couldn't, continue. So he sells the cows and the equipment, and he still had mortgages. So...
Was that common? Was that going on in the area? A lot of other farmers selling out, or
yeah. There was only two farms in New Kingston, the Gray Farm and the Elliott Farm, left. And you know, when I moved to New Kingston in '64, there were 18 dairy farms in that valley.
The Thompson Hollow area.
Thompson Hollow, yeah, and well, not Thompson Hollow, over on. The other side, you know, outside New Kingston, well, the whole New Kingston Valley, basically.
Okay.
You know, it was on Roberts Road and up into the, you know, which is over actually in the town of Roxbury, because our farm was a border between Middletown and Roxbury. And but anyway, that it was a great place to grow up, and you know, when Dad sold the cows, it was a gloomy day, and. You know, he sold the cows and the equipment, and he still had a couple mortgages, you know, liens on the property and all this other stuff. So he hooked up with Redmond Real Estate and started subdividing. And that was a hard thing to see, too. And so when he was subdividing, he had to get a surveyor, and basically all that subdivision stuff and all the laws and contracts he had to sign, and he sold all but 70 acres, and the house and the barn had burnt down. But anyway, later on the barn burnt, but he ended up subdividing, and you know, all that, he never seemed to, he just made enough to basically to hold on the place, you know, the taxes, real estate and town tax and all that. We're about $6,000, $7,000 a year. We kept trying to bail them out. You know, used to be 3 years they'd let you go without payment. And then, you know, about every two and a half years, my brothers and sisters would get together and we'd all take, you know, and pay the taxes so we didn't lose the place. But after a while, you know, I have a company and I was in debt myself and, you know, there was just nothing else we could do. So, you know, we subdivided and sold off what we used to be pastures and meadows. Now there's houses on it. And the original plot, he sold off all but 70 acres. And, you know, it was a wood lot out back and some of the pasture out front. And so when he did the subdivision over on what used to be Day Road is now Thompson Hollow. They renamed it about 10 years ago. And that whole stretch, my brother Eugene, he put a house above the farm on a five-acre parcel because Dad cut out, he broke it up into five and three-quarter acre parcels, anything over 5 acres. And over on the Day Road, he put six parcels over there for the rest of his children because he had seven kids. I bought the first parcel. My brother-in-law, Frank, bought the second one. My sister, Joanne, she bought over a few years, she bought two parcels. But my other brothers and sisters just weren't, you know, interested in owning it. So Dad just came, you know, they were the parcels, and Dad kept paying the taxes on them. And you know, my sister, Colleen, she had and Frank, my brother-in-law, they moved to Florida. And they didn't think they'd ever want to come back. So, you know, I approached them. They were up one summer and at the cabin. And I said, why don't we, you know, sell me your piece and, you know, I'll buy it if you want to sell it. And, that was, you know, then I had 10 acres. And then we built let me get the dates right here. Do-do-do-do. 1986 and '87, we bought the parcels, and over the next several years, my family members moved away, and, you know, their parcels, they put them up for sale, and I kept buying, you know, one parcel, a five-acre parcel at a time, and I had them, you know, I'd buy one that was in between another, so, you know, I was trying to get them all into it took me 25 years to get five parcels in a row.
Oh, yeah.
And I mean, I worked at it, and it wasn't easy. So in 1988, my sons and some friends and myself, we built a 16x16 with a 12x16 porch with a roof hunting cabin down by the Plattekill Stream. We cut the logs at the mill and wore out an old pickup truck hauling the logs from Argyle Mill to the new site in New Kingston. And then once we got to New Kingston, we didn't have a road in. So up by the main road, we had a four-wheeler with a rack on the back. We'd throw one end of the logs. Most of the logs are 8 to, you know, 16 foot long. So, you know, we could take 8s and 10s, and then we'd do 12s and to 16s on one, but anyway, put, you know, 6 or 8 logs and tie them to the back of the four-wheeler, and we made a stone site, because back on the farm, when we picked stone in the field, the farmers, they made these low-rise, you know, they just put runners like a sled. Take a 4x4 and just cut a ski on each side, and then nail a platform with little low racks. So when we got over to the woods, you know, picking stone, we didn't have to pick them up, and, you know, it was right there on the ground. So the tractor pulled it, and we had it hooked up to the hydraulic where when we went over to the woods, where we call it, the kids named it this one Dragon Rocks, because there was this one little, in the middle of the fields, there was a little, it was kind of steep, and there were stone ledges in there, and, you know, trees grew up, and farmers never really, did anything with it, but we dumped stone in there. And this stone sled, so that what gave me the idea. The back of the logs we put on the stone sled, and we tied a rope or a chain to the sled, and, you know, we drive it down into the site by skidding it with the four-wheeler, so the end of the logs didn't drag through the mud and all that stuff. It kept them clean. And by the end of the summer, we had a 16-by-16 cabin up.
So to zoom out a bit, sold the cows and subdivided the property. Was there any reason why these parcels were kept in the family and the other ones were sold off? Was there anything about it that attracted?
No, it was just that, I mean, Dad, he'd sell the other parcels to whoever wanted to buy them, but those ones he selected for his children were going to be for his children. And, you know, although, you know, I had a sister in Indiana, she wasn't interested. I had a brother in Virginia Beach, he wasn't interested. I had a sister down in Okeechobee, and they just were not interested. And so those parcels, you know, just sat there. And, you know, Dad didn't try to sell them. You know, every time one come up for sale, I would buy it. But I couldn't buy too many at a time. I mean, back when Dad first started subdividing in 85, 86, they were getting $6,000 an acre. Well, he sold our parcels.
That much in the 80s, huh?
Yeah. It was a boom that lasted for about 4 to 6 years, and then it went to $2,000 an acre.
Mm-hmm.
Just like overnight. So anyway, that's what happens here in the mountains. But I don't think it's going to happen again.
No?
It's not going to go down to 2,000, I don't believe. But anyway, Dad sold it to us for half price. We were paying $3,000. So, you know, I got a $15,000 mortgage. I mean, the payments were over, I don't know, whatever, 5 years or whatever. It was only $287 a month, and it was easy, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So then when my sister Colleen, you know, sold me their parcel, so I had, over time, five-acre parcels that, you know, after about 25 years, and I put them into I left the cabin on its five-acre parcel, and I put the other four on one parcel where I'm looking to build a house. But the summer we built the cabin, we had the roof on. We had no snow blocks. We had a wood stove in there, and you know, everybody shows up for hunting. That's when hunting started, on a Saturday back then. I mean, a Monday, not on a Saturday. And so we'd meet up there Sunday night, and you know, we had friends come, and you know, they brought, you know, platters of food, and you know, we're all in there, and we start the wood stove, and there was about a foot of snow. And you know, of course, it was on the metal roof. We had no ceiling or insulation. And we started that wood stove. It started raining inside the cabin. So we had tarps up there, and we stapled them to the rafters and put them out over the edge of the snow blocks to run the water out. And then, you know, it was actually pretty comfortable in there. But we spent every year, opening day, we meet up there the night before ever since. And it's become a good, you know, place to meet on now it's a Friday night because it's on a Saturday, but you know, we all get together and we go hunting up there the first day. And early on, we would spend the whole weekend, and then as the boys got older, and you know, my son Mitch, he loves the big mountains, and you know, this year he didn't even hunt there on Saturday morning with us. He popped up out of bed at about 4:30, and he was out on his way, and I said, well, where are you staying today? And he said, well, I'm going to the big mountain. And he was back in camp by 10 o'clock that morning with a nice big 8-pointer. But, you know, he had a rough bow season, so he really, and that, he's, after 20 years of hunting, that's the first time he got one opening day. He never got one opening day on hunting season till this year. So anyway, to go forward from that, I kept buying these parcels, and I finally got five in a row. And back in, let's see, our first year.
So why do you like it up there? Is it just because it's home, or what's the draw?
I have a, it's a beautiful piece of property. It's got the Plattekill Stream running through it.
Yeah.
You know, I spent my whole, from 10 years old to, I left the dairy when I was 17. I still helped out up there, but, I had this other draw that just, I went into the hospital, had my tonsils out, and I never went back home because I had a, since I'm 5 years old, I was getting up 4:35 o'clock every day, milking cows, and, and over in Westkill, my dad had, I think, 17 or 18 cows, and that's when the vacuum system just came, and he had three cows that you couldn't go anywhere near them. They were older, and they never had this anything. They're always milked by hand, so
yeah.
Morning and night, and I always loved being by my dad. That's all I remember. Is I just couldn't. I just felt so bad for him. All he ever did was work, and if I got to wanted to spend time with him, I had to go in the barn or out in the field. So, I would always I'd go out and milk those three cows while he milked the rest of them with the, the DeLaval vacuum system. So, I was always very close to Dad, but it broke his heart and it broke my heart really to leave the farm. But I just got sick and tired of getting up 5 o'clock every morning and milking cows. I mean, I did it through my whole school until I was 17, and I had this couple of days off where I was, I could. Well, long story short, I ended up, not going home, and I moved in with my girlfriend at the time, who ended up being my wife. And I worked in sawmills. I worked, I helped other farmers milk cows. I went up and, when my dad needed help up there, I'd go milk his herd and help the farmhand. But it was something that just, little by little, we kept losing a little more and a little more. But, I'm blessed to still have 27 acres of that property, and I hope it never leaves my family. I think my children are partial to it, too, and it's just a...
Yeah.
But without the cows and all the horses and all the animals there, it's become overgrown, and so now it needs tending. Running the mill and maintenance on my house in Arkville. I'm looking forward to the next couple of years. We broke ground last summer, actually, 2014. I put the septic approval, and we built the leach field, and everything got put through, and finally, last year, I did, in April, I got a plan for a 30 by 40 garage that's going to actually be my workshop. And I'm putting that up first, and then I'll build my house. So I decided to do the garage first so I'd have a place to work on my house. I'll bring all my tools up, and I'll have a nice warm place. I can bring stuff up there and keep it undercover. And
Gary, I just want to ask you, though, what do you think has been lost? I mean, this is probably we talk about farms to forest a lot, and this as being one of the largest turnovers in the natural resources movement, right? Mm-hmm. Biggest changes. What about culturally, though? I mean, the whole country kind of went through this, especially New York State in the 1980s. A lot of farms went under.
Yeah.
What do you think is most lost from that conversion of, as one of my friends said in college, I was driving around with him in Delaware County, and we're roommates in Syracuse, and I went back with him one day to deposit, and a farm just went under, mm-hmm. right? And he goes, oh, now they're consumers. I was like, what did you just say? He goes, well, they're no longer producers, they're consumers now. Mm-hmm. He didn't say it snarky either.
Right, yeah.
He literally said it matter of fact,
Yeah.
It's too bad. Now they're consumers. And yeah. I was like, wow, I never thought about it like that.
Yeah.
So, like, what do you think is the biggest change culturally going from that, you know, your cohort, which is really the last age class of farming in Delaware County for yeah. the most part?
Yeah. Well, I would... What I miss is when we had all the animals on the farm, it was manicured like a huge lawn. And, you know, we used to fish up and down the Plattekill Stream. You can't even get near the stream now. All the willows and the beavers. And I mean, we never had beavers, you know, because there was so much going on there. And we didn't have ticks. I mean, ticks weren't a problem. By the land... overgrowing, the point between turning into a forest, you know, going from like a pasture. I mean, I have 30 and 40 year old trees now and pastures that the cows used to graze on, and it's mostly maple and there's very little ash. But you know, thank goodness for that. I only have about 15 ashes on my 27 acres, but mostly maple. And there's some beech nut, and, you know, they're not real healthy either. But, right. you know, it's I miss not being able to walk along the stream and fish. And, I mean, that was, I mean, barefoot. I mean, the cows made a path because they always followed the stream. And then, you know, every yeah. once in a while where it got low or whatever, a narrows part, they'd cross. But, you know, now it's so overgrown, it's hard to walk through. It's hard to see through. And... you know, like I said, the tick incubator, that's what we've, you know, going from a pasture or a meadow, actually pasture and meadow, to a forest.
Yeah.
It's
ripe for ticks.
It's ripe for yeah. ticks. It's
People
perfect.
Blame climate change. I think it's just the forest regrowing, creating damp conditions.
It is. But see, once the maples are actually the conifers, too, taken over, they... kill the undergrowth, and then you have a forest floor, which it, I mean, ticks can still be there, but I mean, yeah. we always had forests back in the day, older forests, and we never had tick problems. It was non-existent.
But, you know, as someone who wasn't born into a farming family, what do you think perspective-wise? Like how people view land? Because I have my own notions from an outsider looking in about farmers. It's just different. They look at land usage and their neighbors differently than people today.
Farming is a way of life. And it isn't something that – it's like woodworking for me now. It's become, you know, fuel for my soul. And, you know, it's not an easy business to navigate. But I got – you know, if I want to take a day off, I can. Although, you know, having a farmer's blood, I work 7 days a week. And, you know, when I go on vacation, then I take time off. But, you know, I don't get up at, well, I used to for years and years. But, you know, now that, you know, the mill is closed, I don't get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and run anymore. You know, I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and I hang out and I have a nice breakfast and I... sit in the hot tub, and you know, I go down to the mill, you know, my workshop for the most part between 11 and 1 every day.
Right.
But I spend time at my house, I write, and I do stuff that, you know, but I you know, that whole getting up and you know, when I had employees, it seemed like everybody had a problem every day, and it was drama like every day. Same thing on a farm. And one of my most vivid memories were in the winter time on the farm. We had a 3/4 mile road that we had to walk to the bus every day. But it was all open meadows on both sides, and the snow drifted. So I can remember this one, my brother, and we had an old, we didn't have a barn cleaner. We had a manure spreader. We backed in the barn. And there were gutters on each side, and we each had a shovel. And we threw the manure into the spreader, and then we went out to the field to spread it. And, you know, 20 below zero, the wind blowing, it's freaking cold, man.
yeah.
And you know, you're plowing through these drifts, and I can remember this one day in particular. I get out there, and you know, I turn the spreader on, and, you know, just the trip from the barn to the meadow, the frickin' chain froze, and it broke. So now I got a wagon full of manure, and the chain's broke, so we back it into the barn, and we're underneath this thing leaching out cow piss and manure and fixing and putting this thing back together with whatever we had. You know, we back then we didn't have come along, so we'd take either a chain and hook it, two hooks to it and twist it and pull that chain together to replace the broken link. But, you know, it was like every day was like, it wasn't easy. One morning I go out to the barn and, you know, we were up at 2 o'clock in the morning birthing a calf. Her name was Callie. And she was a good milker, and, you know, she was 110, 120 pound a day cow, big cow. But so we just get, you know, go back out at 5 o'clock, and I get out there, and, you know, she's laying down, and her insides are laying in the gutter. And so I ran in the house, and I said to Dad, I said, geez, Callie's got a problem. I don't know what's going on. And but sometimes when that urge to push, when they're having it, it doesn't stop. So what they do is it's called casting their withers. And they push their insides. They just all night, you know, keep struggling and thinking they have another calf coming or something. And this only happened that one time. But, you know, called the vet, and John Fairburn, and he said, just pour warm water over it, you know, her insides until I get there. So we did, and he come back in. He knew how to strategically put them back where they belonged. But then he sewed, well, we call it a tuppy, her vagina up, so that if she did strain, it would hold it in there, which was pretty weird. But this is my life. And
yeah.
So I get to school that morning, and I'm late. And this bitch started chewing me out. And I said, listen. And I told her that story. I said, this is what I had to do this morning. I'll trade places with you any given day. You know, there were times we got up in the morning and we went out and a cow got loose in the winter. And when a cow gets loose, for some reason, all it wants to do is beat up other cows, break water lines, just do damage. We go out there and there'd be a water running all over. And you know, it wasn't an easy life. So anything, but when a kid realizes and lives that, the rest of my life is, you know, I've had tough times, but, you know, I overcome them because, you know, it isn't as hard as it was. Now, this day and age, I find that, I mean, life back then was physically rough. Now it's mentally tough, which is actually a lot more taxing than the physical part.
I'd say it's just a different way of living. I mean, you're talking about ties to the land that are very hard to replace, and we just don't have substitutes.
But I'm addicted to that property, and I'm just so grateful I still have it, and I'm looking forward to finally getting back up there and moving into a house. And actually, the house that I'm building, you look across the valley and you can see the house that I was raised in. Mm. And but
man, they canceled school today when it's too cold.
No, we.
Yeah, the farming doesn't get canceled, does it?
The bus driver. Well, we didn't have snow days too much back then.
Yeah.
And we didn't have cameras back then. I wish I did, but I have, you know, pictures in my mind. Lancey's Hill, we called it. At the bottom of this one hill where Lancey Road is, there used to be two high banks. And what they did when they built the road in old days, they cut through this mound, and that thing, we were stuck on the farm for 3 days while the town of Middletown was busting through that. And I remember we had a Volkswagen bus, and they made, I mean, they used backhoes and bulldozers to get through that drift. What it did, you know, when a drift drifts, it somehow packs like it's almost ice, and it's tough. But, you know, we were stuck and back in there. We couldn't get out for 3 days. And then finally when they broke through and we could get out, we drove down with this VW bus, and it was like just about, you know, a foot or two wider than the vehicle. And you could look up, and, I mean, it was 12 feet high. Just snow drift.
Especially so many fields back then, right?
Yeah. And then, what Bill Russell did when he took over, because then they put snow fences up and they tried to slow it down, but it really always drifted there. So when Bill Russell was in charge up there, he come up one summer and he took that whole mountain away and cut it down. And, you know, they used the gravel for working on the roads and that. And, I mean, it just eliminated that problem, because what it was, you know, a hole in between two mountains that just filled in with snow every winter. But that one winter was incredible. And, you know, when it's 20 below zero and the wind blows snow and it settles, it turns really, 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 really hard. But I love the property up there, and it's become, you know, like I say, I'm addicted to it, and I just want to get back up there and you know, finish my days. And I want to become I want to work full-time on the property and take care of the diseased trees and you know, get a brush hog and kind of knock some of that stuff down and make it. I mean, thank goodness there's still, you know, people that, you know, cut the meadows and bale it every year and keep some of it green, because it's nice. I mean, I like the forest, but I don't want to be all forest. We have to have some green and open lands and you know, but, you know, like there's most of New Kingston is the meadows are still, the hay is cut, and, you know, it's a pretty good market for, you know, the firewood guys, they get equipment, and through the summer they make hay bales. And in the winter they, you know, in fall and winter they harvest, you know, firewood. But it's just, but it keeps the, you know, the greenery and the openness, because we don't want it all to be closed in. And I don't mind my young forest, but I need to go through and start pruning and taking care of it and opening it up.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, a lot of that, I imagine, takes time and
takes
labor
a lot of energy.
You know, it doesn't pay, but it really makes a difference.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest, and tonight we're talking to Gary Mead about his New Kingston property.
Every time you see me going somewhere,
All right. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talking about a different forest-related topic. Every third Wednesday, we talk to Gary Mead from Gary Mead Gallery. And tonight, we're talking about his history up there in New Kingston.
Well, if the 70 acres and the house, 1998 got sold at a tax auction. You know, I was in debt, and most of my brothers and sisters were too. We tried to bail it out, but we just couldn't. So anyway, in that fall, they exited the house, and a new owner showed up and took over. And that was a moving moment. So now I was more attached to what I had than ever, and I just kept. But there were still open parcels over there that I think I had three at that point. And like I say, it took me about 25 years to acquire them all and get them all, because I'd buy one that, you know, there was, I owned 1, 2, and 3. 4 was owned by the new owners, and 6. And I wanted to get 5. And, you know, we had, finally, after a while, they did sell it to me, but they, you know, when they first took the place over, they were very, you know, agreeable. Oh, yeah, we'll sell it. And I called them a year later and said, no, we don't want to sell that. And then they made a comment. I said, well, all I want to do is put a house over there, and, you know, if I could own that own stretch of land and retire. And they said, oh, we don't want to see another house over there. And I thought, well, I never really thought too highly of them after that, because, you know, this was, you know, basically a very tough time for us, and they didn't care. They just got what they wanted, and that was that. But, so anyway, you know, I never disrespected them, or, you know, I always tried to, you know, I went over and I sat on the porch and had coffee with them and that, and they worked on the house, and, you know, they fixed it up and kept it up nice, and put a pond in, and they always invited me into the house, and I said, I don't want to see it how it is, I want to remember how it was. So I never went back into that house, because, you know, I didn't want to disturb the memories I had of it, and, you know, I don't care what they changed it into. It's, I mean, it was a, all my brothers and sisters, you know, we look back and we say, damn, we didn't know how good we had it back then. Because it's, you know, every one of us couldn't wait to leave. And then once we left, we go, man, we had it made back there. We shouldn't have, we don't know why. We just, you know, everybody just wanted to get the heck out of there. But, you know, it was we had a great childhood, and we, you know, we filled 2 silos and put up about 14,000 to 18,000 bales of hay, and cousins and from Ashland and Jewett and Hunter and down in Long Island would come up and spend the summer with us. And we had a hut down by the river that back then you could dam the river up, and we had a beautiful, well, we called it the hut. When we first moved to the farm, my dad, there was an old chicken coop up by the farm, and he cut 2 beech logs and jacked it up and put them under it and attached it to it and dragged it down to the river. So we put a floor in it and put bunk beds in it. And all summer, we never went to the house. It was a good part of a 3/4 mile walk down to the hut, but then back up the hill in the morning was a little bit, you know, going. It was uphill all the way, so, it, you know, getting up fresh, but, you know, we used to run right up there, and it didn't make no never mind. But it was a beautiful place to grow up, and it was, you know, very easy. We went to Margaville for the carnival during the summer, and we'd go over to see our grandma and grandpa over in Jewett, and that would be about the only time that we left the farm. As, you know, it was we were busy, and we worked sun up to sundown, and couldn't wait to get down to the hut, and we didn't sleep in the house all summer long. We basically went down to the hut every single night. You know, if it was a torrential, you know, thunder, lightning storm, you know, then we probably didn't go down, but most of the time we went down, and it was a wonderful, but we built this dam across the river that backed it up the river a quarter of a mile. It was still about probably 3 feet deep all the way back up that far. We had snorkels, and you know, the in front of the dam it was 7 to 8 feet deep, and we used to back the wagon. We had this little dump trailer. We'd back that up in a Massey Ferguson. We backed that up to the edge of the pond, and we dove off the back of that, and you know, it was, and snorkeling and fish, and I caught a 19-inch brown trout out of that one year.
Wow.
Right after milking, because my dad was a fly fisherman. Right after milking, we went down, you know, we get done around in the summertime, about, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock, and still just getting dark, and you know, the flies are out, and but Dad was amazing. He had this little basket on the side, and on the way down, he'd catch whatever's flying around, look at it, tie the damn thing up, and put it on the pole. But this one night, we had a fly already tied, and you know, he had a fly rod, and I had one, and that's all we fished with. I didn't even know what a spinning rod or any of that stuff. Never until I left the farm, I had no idea what they were. But anyway, we seen a fish jump, and that's the night Dad told me. He says, sneak down there, and he said, you're going to catch him. You're definitely going to catch that trout. But he said, if you can see in the water, they can see. If you can see them, they can see you. If you're shadowing on the water, then they can't see you. They, and so, you know, that was one of the tricks that he taught me about fishing. So, you know, you crawl and you do whatever and get you down there, and, you know, I'm drying the fly out, and I set it on the water, and boom, it took that thing, and I pulled that thing in, and it was like, it was a highlight of my life up there, basically, to catch this 19-inch brown trout out of that tiny little stream.
That's awesome.
It was amazing.
Yeah.
But it was only there. Well, we had a club there at that time, and we used to stock every spring, we'd stock it with the brown trout. The brookies were always there. But, you know, now I don't know if there's even any trout left in there between the... you know, nobody's stocking it, and you know, the fishers and everything that are you know, taking them. And we have a blue herring,
yeah,
family up there that's been on the property for years, and you know, ever since we moved there. But and one summer, Dad used to let people go down there fishing, and you know, this one fisherman, he let fish there, come back and said, oh, don't worry, I shot that damn herring for you. And Dad goes, geez, what the hell did you do that for? He said he was eating the fish, and Dad says, well, that's what they eat.
Yeah, right.
So we sent him packing, said, don't ever come back here again. But every summer, we still see that same blue herring family that is, it's just, they've probably been there for hundreds of years, and they're you know, I welcome them, and I have no animosity against them, because you know, they're just making a life for themselves. And it's not like there's 15 or 20 of them. You know, we see one, there's a pair of them up there, and
yeah,
wherever they have their offsprings, they must go and you know,
you don't think the other farmers are shooting them though?
Well, I'm sure. Back when I was,
it had to make a difference.
Back when I was a kid, they used to shoot bald eagles.
Everything, really.
Everything was meant to be shot, and it was. But that was a way of life on the farm, and I didn't. You know, I stopped hunting for 10 years because I was kind of ashamed of you know, killing chipmunks and birds and, you know, with BB guns and all this stuff. And you know, when Matt, my son, was 2 years old, I quit hunting, and I didn't hunt for 10 years. And when Matt turned 12, he wanted to go small game hunting. And my cousin was going to take him out, and I said, geez, I'm his dad. So I went and reinstated my license, and, you know, I took all my kids small game hunting and this and that. But, you know, it was really easy to squirrels. I like venison because you can take a, you know, one kill and it'll last you all winter.
Yeah.
But, you know, as far as a partridge or a squirrel, it isn't even a meal.
Right.
And you're taking a life for not even a meal. So that, to me, doesn't seem righteous enough. So, but, you know, I like wild game, and but I don't shoot partridges anymore. And when I blackberry pick on my property, the low bush blackberries, ones that hang down toward the ground, they don't grow tall when they're under in the shade a little bit. And, you know, I pick, you know, anywhere from 25 to 30 quarts of blackberries every year. And if I see there's one part of my property that there's these low bush in there, and, you know, 10, 12 years ago I was going up there to blackberry pick, and, you know, I'm picking these, but they're nice and juicy because they're undercover and they don't get a lot of sun, and they were big. And I saw, I'm walking through there picking, and six or seven partridges, one at a time, flew out. And I said, well, geez, this is theirs. You know, I'll go somewhere else and get them. Because the high ones, I tried to picture a partridge in flight trying to pick a blackberry off a bush, and I don't think they can do it. So I don't know how they would get the high ones. So these ones that were lower to the ground, I always left them for the partridges. And, you know, when the kids were, you know, learning how to hunt and that, it was awesome to have them, you know, have the skill to be able to sneak up to a partridge and take one out. And my grandfather, Meade, he was about the best partridge hunter I ever come across. He could hear them. Because they make this funny little weird thing with their feet and whatever before they fly. And he rarely shot at them in the air. He would shoot them in the blind.
Jeez.
You know, before they left the ground.
Holy cow.
He was like lightning fast with that. It's amazing. But, you know, I was hard pressed, so I could hit one after. Because what they do is that you get, you know, 10, 12 feet away from them, and then they fly out and they startle you. So you have this, you know, 2 seconds where you're trying to get your bearings and they're gone. And then they don't fly straight away. They curve and up and down. And
your grandparents are from the Greene County, that West Coast area?
Yeah. Well, they're over in Jewett. And
it's a pretty mountainous area as well.
Yeah, they've been, they were all hunters, and they did, you know, we had, in our cabin, we have my grandpa Graff. He shot a nice big six-pointer in Spruceton in 1949, and we have that in our cabin, mounted, and then in the late 60s, my grandpa and grandma both shot one the same year, and they're mounted, and we have them in our cabin.
And, so you took a hiatus from hunting, and what brought you back, I guess, was
my son,
just the interest of the younger generation?
Yeah, my son wanting to go hunting, and I didn't want somebody else to show him how to go hunting, so that's when I started hunting again. And we used to love turkey hunting. I don't do much of that anymore, but I will take a turkey there. I mean, especially one summer, we had about 300 to 500 in New Kingston Valley. For some odd reason, they just really, you know, it was overwhelming up there. But, you know, you rarely see a turkey or a bear up there now. But, I mean, there's bear, you know, a mama bear with cubs. I didn't see her this summer, but I usually every summer I see her. And she usually has 2 or 3 cubs. And a couple of years ago, she had 3 of them running around with her. But, you know, and they're so awesome to see. But I don't, I never shot a bear. And we had them back on the farm. I remember going up on the high mountains and seeing bear track up there. So they it isn't something that's, you know, just new, but they become a lot more.
Oh, yeah, they're in Newburgh. Yeah. That's about all the time we got on From the Forest, believe it or not. We made it up to about maybe early 2000s.
1998.
It's not bad.
I think it was the last date.
All right. Well, next week we're going to have Cornell on, talk about moose in New York. Obviously, mostly the Adirondacks, but that's all the time I got. And thanks for listening.
Well, peace, everybody, and have a good winter, and it will be spring before we know it.
That's right. Take care. Have a good night.
Oh, the neon lights were flashing, and the icy wind did blow. The water seeped into his shoes, and the drizzle turned to snow. His eyes were red, his hopes were dead, and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. Jet soars above the canyon streets, and the con men con, but life goes on, for the city never sleeps. And to an old forgotten soldier, the dawn will come no more. For the old